This year's prestigious Wolfson History Prize has been won by a book called The Boundless Sea, A Human History of the Oceans. Dr. David Abulafia is the author. He's an English historian with a special interest in the Mediterranean. He spent most of his career at Cambridge University and retired in 2017, so he's now Professor Emeritus, but still a visiting prof at the New University of Gibraltar, in case you didn't know there was one there, and also at the College of Europe in Poland. This is a sweeping, epic chronicle of the relationship between us and our oceans, the great explorers, pirates, the slave trade. It's all in these 1,000 pages, and fascinating revelations about the maritime exploits, not just of the famous seafaring countries and cultures, but also the Swedes, Russians, Danes, Armenians. Who knew? And yet Professor Abulafia says in his preface, "I have not attempted to write what pretends to be a complete or comprehensive history of the oceans." Great to have you on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your award-winning history, you know, The Great Sea, about the Mediterranean, was pretty epic. And you've outdone yourself with this new one. I mean, it may not be a complete history, as you say in the preface, but readers will think it comes pretty darn close. I bet no one has said to you, David, you left out stuff.
Well, it's a very good question, because one of the challenges of writing this sort of book, and it was also true of the Mediterranean book, which was only 700 pages, but slightly larger print, and this one is over 1,000, one of the big challenges is knowing what to leave out, because you can't put it all in. So I've described this new book as, it's not a complete history, it's a rounded history, by which I meant that, you know, I've tried to make the connections, I've tried to sort of draw things together right round the globe. You know, that's the only way you can write that sort of book. You have to sort of home in on what you think are the really revealing examples. So completeness was never my aim.
Right. I do have to correct one grievous error of yours on page 31 regarding, quote, "By far the largest islands in Polynesia and the most inhospitable climatically, the North and South Islands of New Zealand." Did you have a few bad days in Wellington?
I must admit I did. It rained a great deal, and I'd been warned that it's a very windy and wet city. I was there in your winter, so it was July. I mean, it was the time of the year when we're now speaking. And, I mean, well, the weather actually wasn't that bad, really. It wasn't cold or anything like that. But I can't say that I was endeared to the weather.
We have a saying here, actually, you can't beat Wellington on a good day.
I found it a very attractive city.
Yeah, it is.
There is something, rather from a British perspective, it's very reminiscent of some, if you don't mind my saying so, some of the sort of bigger provincial cities in Britain, Leeds, Sheffield, places like that, because it's sort of small and intimate, easy to get around. I enjoy being there very much. And the museum, Te Papa, is tremendous.
You're making up for your comment about the weather now. That's grand.
Absolutely, yeah.
As you say, you've gone from a sea, the Mediterranean, that accounts for only 0.8% of the maritime surface of the globe, to the seas that cover 70% of the world's surface. So was that a daunting shift, even for you? Was that a bit daunting in prospect?
Well, that was part of the challenge, part of the fascination, actually, to get drawn into this, and sometimes actually to find out that a lot of the work that I thought would exist about Chinese crossing the sea and so on hadn't really been done. There were those challenges, but I felt that somehow I'd already been preparing myself for them over a good many years, just, you know, looking at my bookshelves, realizing the sorts of things that I'd been collecting, as if deep down somewhere in my cortex, I'd sort of known what I wanted to do, but I'd never actually expressed it to myself.
Yes, and that's what I wanted to ask you, actually, because your book is far more than just a collection of countries and cultures. Do you remember a period from your childhood, a sort of John Masefield kind of impulse that grew in you regarding the oceans and the seas?
Yes, though I have to say the Mediterranean. As I grew up, I had this particular fascination, not just with, you know, the Roman Empire, as it were. But it was actually to do with the connections. It was to do with how all these bits fitted together. And of course, that's something which comes into the new book. I have quite a lot of material there about the Vikings going right across the Atlantic centuries before Columbus.
Yes, you do. But your heroes in the main, or on the main, excuse the pun, are not so often, you know, the explorers who opened up routes across the oceans, but the merchants who followed in their wake. You have an affection for the people we don't know so much about. Why?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, if we talk about explorers, we're talking about people who sometimes accidentally, you know, in the case of Columbus, it was, you know, he didn't really know where he was going. They've sort of turned up somewhere, and it's the same with the European discovery and perhaps also the Maori discovery of New Zealand. So, you know, accidental discoveries, people perhaps going out to sort of look for lands which, according to legend, existed over the horizon. But what really interested me was how people then sort of followed that up. Now, in the case of these Vikings who ended up in what is now Canada, in Newfoundland, they didn't. They retreated back to Greenland, where they stayed for 400 years plus, but they didn't, as far as we know, ever go that far south along the coast of America again. They popped across to collect wood in northern Canada, and that was about it. So it's the creation of a sort of regular routine, a sort of rhythm of contact, and that was maintained really by the merchants. So after Columbus, within a few years, within the next 10 years, you begin to see a regular flow of ships going back and forth, collecting gold which had been collected, they'd been forced to collect it, the native inhabitants of the main island, Hispaniola, you know, now Dominican Republic and Haiti, sometimes bringing back slaves, so that was discouraged. So these trade routes opened up. What's really fascinating is then you start thinking about the objects that are moving back and forth. In the great era of Dutch trade, you know, fantastic quantities of Chinese ceramics and also Japanese ones later on coming all the way to the West. And it's that contact between cultures and how it, you just think about how that influenced the culture of Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. Also the development of the tea plantations in China, which service this phenomenal demand for tea in all the European countries and across the Atlantic in America. You know, tea had an important role in the American Revolution against George III, the Boston Tea Party, and so on. So these contacts across sometimes enormous spaces, and then beyond objects, you've got the ideas. You've got the spread of Islam from the West by sea. We've got descriptions of how the rulers of Malacca in Malaysia converted to Islam. It's all a bit legendary. You've also got the spread of Buddhism, again, by sea. One thing I write about, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, the diary of a Japanese monk in the 9th century who goes to China by sea. So we know all about his sea voyage, and then he has contact with this great pirate Chang Pogo, who a very controversial figure who looks after him and so on. So these cultural contacts, which are made possible because the trade routes are open by and large.
Yes, but not just cultural, not just religious either. You give capitalism a good name, actually, which you remind us of its vigour. But the entrepreneurial impulse hasn't just been capitalistic, as you know, as we learn from your book, as I guess as we always knew. It's in our blood to roam, or it used to be. And just as an aside, we've run out of room for roaming. Does this tell you that, for example, that Elon Musk will get to Mars, actually? Because the world was very different then. When those Vikings touched on the northern shores of Canada, they must have wondered what lay beyond, and there was so much that they hadn't got to, but we've run out now.
We have run out, and actually that takes me to the end of the book, really, because it's a sort of complaint that, you know, in the right up to, the middle of the 20th century, perhaps even a bit beyond that, there was regular passenger traffic across the oceans. What we now look at, of course, is the disappearance of all of that and the substitution. If people want to take a passenger ship, it is in 99.9% of cases going to be a cruise ship. People sort of looking for the most remote little corners, the most remote little islands. And it is having, I think, quite a sort of deleterious effect sometimes.
Yeah. But once it was boundless, the boundless sea, a human history of the oceans, Dr. David Abulafia is with us. So you came to Wellington for some of your research. The Māori explorers get a mention early on. You start in our neck of the woods, actually, with the Pacific Ocean in 176,000 BC. And that's when there was evidence of humanity in Australia and the islands to its north, isn't it?
Yeah, the evidence for movement into Australia, it's difficult, of course, to work out exactly what's going on, but it does look as if the first settlers settled round the edges. And I was actually just looking at an article a day or two ago where it appears that at a time when the sea level was lower, there were quite a lot of Australian settlements just under what's now the water's edge. They've been discovering new ones along the coast of North Australia. On the one hand, it's the most amazing process that you've got this movement all the way from the Solomon Islands near New Guinea all the way to Easter Island, encompassing also Hawaii way up north, New Zealand way down south. Extraordinary phenomenon. And yet, when you actually think of it from another perspective, you have to admit, well, it does take tens of thousands of years. A lot of islands in the Atlantic were settled very, very late. And yet you have these entrepreneurial Polynesians. Why are they doing it? That's one of the great mysteries.
Their prowess, too. I mean, the prowess of the Polynesian, Melanesian, Micronesian sailors must rank highly in the total scheme of exploration, because the admiration comes through in this book.
It is extraordinary what they were able to do. All of this without paper. It's all done just using sticks and sand and models made, for the purpose. So enormous amount of oral information about how to navigate in these boats with their outriggers, sort of catamaran-type boats. And the expertise they built up was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, just being able to feel from the movement of the water under the boat, where they might be, being able to work out how far away land was, knowing the pattern of the constellations, it's just breathtaking, actually, and in many ways superior to the knowledge of the Europeans. There's the story I tell about the captain who loses his compass overboard.
That's right.
And he's got a schooner. He's trying to get to a Polynesian island. He's an English captain. And he says to his crew, who are all Polynesians, which was quite common, this would be, I suppose, about 1800 or something, we're lost. How do I, I don't have my compass, we're totally lost. And they say, don't worry, Captain, we'll get you there. And they do. And he just cannot understand how they've managed to achieve this. He says, how did you know the island was here? To which they give this extraordinarily obvious answer. But it's always been here. They just had this extraordinary knowledge of the environment in which they were living, which is so different to the environment in which peoples across the rest of the globe live, an environment consisting exclusively of scattered groups of islands, small islands. So you just compare that to, the shores of the Indian Ocean or whatever.
Yeah. Learning how to feel the waves. A phrase from your book. Have we lost talents we once had, do you suspect?
I think we have, absolutely. And I think that story about the captain shows that it does go back a long way.
And we've come at it from an Anglo-centric point of view. I'm sure that both you and I had many people listening had a similar education in that respect. I mean, Columbus disappointed that he met only natives and there were no exotic monsters. You write in your book. So he didn't know a lot. He only knew a certain amount setting out. We're having a Black Lives Matter related argument here. It's been running for a while about statues of and the honouring of Captain Cook. And I'm not asking you to take sides. But he is prominent in your text, Cook. And, of course, Tupaia, his companion, who had that feeling for the waves you're talking about. And Cook's accomplishments, how would you sum them up?
Well, his involvement with scientific research. Now, there are various ways of looking at this. Joseph Banks, you know, being on board and so on. What was the purpose of this scientific research? Some of it was pure science. They wanted to observe the transit of Mercury across the sun. Absolutely, you know, that was a very interesting astronomical issue. But it was also bound up with empire building, there's no doubt about it. Since it wasn't just the English, it was also the French, very much. You know, Louis XVI, apparently on the eve of his execution, he was still worried about the expeditions that he'd sent down into towards Australia and New Zealand. So my view is, you know, you can keep your statues of Captain Cook if you have, you know, adequate explanations, and by all means add statues of, you know, whether it's Coupe, one of the legendary discoverers of Aotearoa, or whether it is Tupaio, whom you've mentioned in, you know, as this extraordinary Polynesian navigator. But we mustn't take these people out of our historical memory, because then we end up with actually a rather corrupted view of the past, in which, you know, the bad people need to be there. Be in our account of the past.
Well, we'll either keep adding context in the way you recommend, and of course that's a conversation here, or else you'll have Oliver Cromwell and Winston Churchill both disappear in the UK, won't you?
You will. I mean, Cromwell doesn't emerge at all well from his treatment of the Irish, but he fought against a particularly sort of authoritarian view of the, which Charles I was expressing of his monarchic powers. And so, you know, there's a part of him that is a great national hero, and there's another part of him that we have to own up to, and the best way to own up to it is to leave him in place. And the idea of Churchill, I mean, you know, Churchill, of course, he had some very, I'll call them old-fashioned views, but really, you know, unpleasant views about other peoples and so on. But there's absolutely no doubt that his achievement on behalf of the United Kingdom, I mean, you know, he is really one of the very greatest figures in British history, and you just can't get away from that.
The Boundless Sea, A Human History of the Oceans, and Dr. David Abulafia is with us. You have fun in this book as well. Pirates, because when you get into the Caribbean, pirates were more like Long John Silver and Captain Jack Sparrow than we realised. They had rum and red bandanas. Many of the pirates of the Caribbean were what we'd call contractors these days, David.
Yeah, privateers is the term that I would tend to use, which means that they have a sort of, they have the backing, explicit or nearly explicit, of very often the English Queen or the English King. I mean, Elizabeth I, you think of her relationship with Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh and so on. Those galleons carrying silver across the Atlantic were too good to miss. So the best way to deal with that was to be able to disown the activities of the privateers and pretend that, well, that they weren't privateers, they were just rogue pirates. But then, you know, what happens, someone like Henry Morgan comes back to England and he's knighted. So you begin to see how really there is this sort of collusion between the pirates and the English crown. One of the very interesting things is how the ships, the pirate ships, were sort of treated as republics in which the captain would sort of muck in with the crew and so on, rather sort of egalitarian sorts of places. And I suppose because there was a sense that they'd all invested in this very risky sort of activity, attacking other ships and, you know, risking their lives in order to enrich themselves.
Yeah. The other aspect is how much we still don't know. I mean, if places like the Solomon Islands were being visited 30,000 years ago, who by, what were they like? Could the theorists of early New Zealand settlement be right, even though we think it's fanciful and sometimes also with a racial sort of agenda? But you ask in the book, you know, where did we get our sweet potato plants from? Case in point.
There are those odd things, and, you know, rat bones found in New Zealand and other islands which seem to predate the arrival of humans. And, you know, how would rats get there except on ships? mean, when one talks about New Zealand, these legends which the Maoris told about people who were already there, the descriptions of them don't make them sound like real people at all. Mm. And yet, on the other hand, you know, there is this extraordinary series of discoveries that's happened in the eastern Indonesian islands of these miniature human beings, sometimes called hobbits. Who may have survived up to the arrival of our own type of human. So
there's an obvious question about the hobbits. I mean, if the little hobbit humans of Indonesia, who you say had the brains the size of chimpanzees, were able to cross the sea, you know, you compare that with people like Tupaia and the Polynesian sailors and the Māori who came down here, and they had enormous sophistication by comparison. They just didn't have guns, germs and steel. So it makes you wonder what they achieved that we still don't know about.
Well, one of the points I make, which I don't think people have really made clearly enough, is that as humans spread across the vasts of landmass of the world, of course, you know, we think it's a choice between land and sea, but actually to get all the way to the east coast of China or whatever from somewhere in the heart of Eurasia, you've got to cross lakes and rivers and all sorts of things. There are watery obstacles as well. It really does seem to me that early types of human must have had some ability to move across water. My guess is that we greatly underestimate the brain power of some of these early types of human. It now looks as if Neanderthals had an intelligence similar to that of contemporary ordinary humans, and that may go way back in time as well. You know, to what extent is the size of the brain the determinant? Not for me to say, but
a lot we won't get to say, unfortunately, time's against us, but there's not much neglected in your book. The slave trade, very topical at the moment. The sea level changes, the winds, the nature of the trade, the things people... The trade in precious goods was corrupting society and making us soft a long, long time ago. It's extraordinary how that echoes down through the ages and is still redolent today. You know, we've become too soft as a society. That conversation's always been had too.
Yes, it's very striking actually how in ancient Rome, where they were importing these absolutely phenomenal quantities of pepper from India, they were spending millions and millions of the local coin sesterces on this, and the great geographer, natural historian Pliny, in the early imperial period in the first century AD, he complains about this. He's always going on about how, you know, once upon a time we weren't softies, we didn't depend on all these sort of luxuries from the east.
We've got to go, but is there, and so much not yet covered, but as you say, it's a book of 1,000 pages. Is there one seafaring race you admire above all the rest?
I have to sort of take my hat off to the Portuguese and the way in which they opened up the routes around the southern tip of Africa into the Indian Ocean, the way that they colonized Atlantic islands, Madeira, the Azores, Cape Verde Islands. But of course, there's a very negative side to this as well. So it comes back to the whole statue question, good and bad, which is that, you know, you have to see them as the founders of the Atlantic slave trade. But then, of course, also, by comparison, one's bound to go back to the Polynesians and say, well, they were just exceptional. I mean, what they managed to do in colonizing that great open space of the largest ocean in the world is, it's a truly epic story. So it would be a choice between Portuguese and Polynesians, I think.
Actually, I'll just squeeze this in, last question, because I know that every age has its quota of bold men and women, but there's something that you marvel at right through this book, the sheer courage required to set out into the unknown the way the Vikings did, and the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Chinese and the Polynesians and the Maori. Why do you think they were able to risk more than we would today, perhaps? Because there was still unknown to know about?
Yes, sometimes it was to do with curiosity, sometimes it was to do with hardship. I mean, people, you know, you had Vikings in Ireland and elsewhere who found living conditions difficult or got into arguments with their neighbours and ended up in Iceland, colonised Iceland, which, you know, was not the most attractive environment in which to settle. You have to remember they lived in a world in which mortality was much higher. Children, great proportion of children, didn't survive very long beyond their birth and so on. Perhaps, I'm not saying that life was cheaper, life was certainly valued very much by those who lived it, but there was perhaps an acceptance sometimes that taking the risk to cross the seas was not significantly more dangerous than just sort of living at home in lands which might well be devastated by the Black Death or whatever. The sort of caution that we've developed, extreme caution we've developed. So you wouldn't dream of getting on an aeroplane if you were told, well, this particular model, I mean, think of the Boeing 737 MAX. You know, nobody in his right mind wants to go on one of those. In the Middle Ages, you know, you got on a ship, you hoped you would arrive, you knew that a very high percentage of ships in the course of their life, which might be 20 years or something, these ships would eventually quite possibly founder. So it's a different attitude, I think, to the risks that one would take.
Yeah, and well described, as we'd expect. Thank you very much for your time with us.
You're very welcome.
Professor David Abulafia, The Boundless Sea.